Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. You know, it's hard to find a night when there isn't a book talk happening in Seattle. Our fair city has a reputation with authors. We're a major hit on the book tour circuit because we read a lot. Okay, so we dropped to number 4 last year in Amazon's list of most well-read cities. After Miami? Come on, 12s, we can do better next year in many more ways than one. But we're up there, and writers know it. You have a wealth of talks to choose from. Too many. You can't make it to all of them, so we do our best to bring them to you. So off we go. Patton Oswalt is an American comedian, writer, and actor. His parents named him after World War II General George Patton. The LA Times later referred to him as, quote, the Dean of Nerd Comics. You may recognize him as the voice of Remy in Ratatouille.
No! No, this is terrible! He's ruining the soup!
Or from his portrayal of Spence Olchin in the TV comedy King of Queens.
Hey, Arthur! I just dropped by to see if you want to catch a movie.
Oswalt's first book was Zombie Spaceship Wasteland, a collection of personal essays about the self-described wasteland of his suburban youth. Here he reads a chapter from his new book, Silver Screen Fiend, learning about life from an addiction to film. Before we start, I must say apologies in advance to our wonderful sister city, Tacoma. Sorry he got the wrong impression. Seattle Arts and Lectures presented this visit by Patton Oswalt to Town Hall Seattle on January 31st, 2015. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for this recording. Please be advised, the following segment contains situations and language of an adult nature.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Rebecca Hughes, and I'm the Associate Director of Seattle Arts and Lectures. I'm delighted to welcome you to an evening with actor, comedian, and writer, Patton Oswalt. The format for this evening will be a brief reading by Patton, followed by a conversation moderated by George Meyer. The charming and Emmy Award-winning George Meyer has written for Late Night with David Letterman, Saturday Night Live, and The Simpsons. It is a terrifying pleasure to introduce the multi-talented, multifaceted Patton Oswalt. He is a comedian, an actor, and as he demonstrates again in this follow-up to his best-selling first memoir, Zombie Spaceship Wasteland, a very talented writer. The new book describes yet another side to this Renaissance man, his descent from sun-blasted LA into the celluloid underworld, as a self-described, quote, movie freak mole man. For 4 years, Oswalt went on a filmic bender, soaking up classics and new releases. Binge-watching, Oswalt practically invented the term. The Seattle Times called the book a vivid, funny trip down a particular rabbit hole, and the New York Times praised it, saying, Oswalt's writing gives off the hallucinogenic shimmer of the true obsessive, packing all the sharpness and bite of his stand-up. As much as the book is about film, however, it is more largely about creativity, risk-taking, art-making. Oswalt is a base jumper of an artist, risking the lowest lows to reach those highest highs. This is a book about the rooms he entered and left changed, about the way art influences art. Yes, it's funny, but even more than that, it's inspiring. The New York Times wrote that, quote, the world's brain is lucky to have Oswalt knocking around in there, making connections, sparking those synapses, lighting us up. We are lucky to have Oswalt in this brain of a room tonight with all you brains out there. So, hive mind, prepare to be lit up. Please join me in welcoming the one and only Patton Oswalt.
Thank you. Wow, it is genuinely great to be in Seattle. You have no idea. I was in Tacoma last night, and they're very nice people there. No one had told me about the stench in the air, the weird. I don't know how people. I don't know if people live there. I think that people go there. And I think the stench maybe runs things. And then people show up for food and shows, and then they all... It was the... I'm just so happy to be... You have no idea. I'm so happy to be here. Oh, my God. Oh, thank you. And it sucks. I have to leave in the morning tomorrow. And we know... I know. Tomorrow in Seattle at 3 o'clock, you're... The local PBS station is doing a Miss Marple marathon, and I was hoping to see that. You know, that's a great... They're showing all the episodes. I think it's like 8 hours worth. I mean, look, you guys are going to be glued to the TV, but I'm going to miss it. They're not, you know. So, oh well. They asked me to read a couple of excerpts from the book, which I'm going to do now. They're nice and short, and then I'm going to sit and talk. To George, who's hilarious and wonderful, and then we'll take your questions. And again, thank you so much for coming out tonight. There are a lot of cool things to do in this city, so thank you for choosing me. Honestly, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to start off. This is a little thing in the middle. This is one of my nights at the New Beverly Cinema in Los Angeles, where I basically let 4 years of my life get chewed away watching movies every night and day, $5 double feature every night, and I would encounter a lot of people on the spectrum of obsession, if you will. I got into the deep orange, and there were people there that were in the infrared all the time. But not only did I get to encounter... I would guess, you know, other film fiends like myself, I also got to encounter some legendary cultural icons, as this quick thing will show you. So, we were 15 minutes into the movie. Citizen Kane is structured in so many interdependent flashbacks that even now, having seen it close to 20 times, I couldn't tell you what was happening at that point in its story. All I know is I was rapt. The theater and world around me were gone, and I was watching Charles Foster Kane chew and bully his way to the top of a mountain he was about to go tumbling down the other side of, and he was going to drain so much love and patience and charity out of everyone he knew in the ascent that none of them would have the energy to run around the other side of that mountain and catch him when he plummeted. You know what's going to happen every single time you see it, but it's such a sweet ride. It's like body surfing a wave that you know is going to send you belly first into abrasive sand. Still, you could never resist the swell when you feel it rise. But there was a noise behind me, a rumbling, human but maybe not human gurgle and bark. Someone was sitting down 15 minutes into Citizen Kane, and they were talking to no one, out loud. God damn it. I turned around to shush whoever was pulling me out of Wells's cinematic gravity. It was Lawrence Tierney. Reservoir Dogs Lawrence Tierney, bar brawling, knife wound surviving, battling bruiser, T-shirted human tank, Lawrence Tierney, sitting alone in the dark behind me watching Citizen Kane. I didn't shush him. For about 15 minutes, he sat there talking to the screen as if he were just out of view to the other characters, admonishing Kane, "Don't clap for that squawking bitch. She can't sing. Sit down, you chump." "Oh, Jesus, what's he staring at? You gonna cry, fancy man?" He actually said, "Are you gonna cry, fancy man?" It was the best DVD commentary I've ever heard. Suddenly, there was a younger man behind him, his handler. I found out later from Sherman Torgan, who owned the New Beverly, a young kid who'd landed the exhausting, unenviable job of attempting to guide a driverless tractor of a human being like Lawrence Tierney through his remaining days. Larry, how long you been in here? We gotta go. Lawrence said, we do? Yeah? Yeah, they're waiting. Lawrence stood up. He considered the screen one last time. I ain't ever seen this sucker, he said. It's not half bad. And then he was gone. This was a professional actor, a noir icon who'd end up with a more than 50-year career, and he'd never seen Citizen Kane. But the 15 out-of-context minutes he just watched after missing the first 15 weren't half bad. All right. So this is a very brief chapter called Overdosing, and this is how bad my movie obsession got, basically, of my going to movies over and over again. That was kind of the Citizen Kane moment was when I was at the beginning of it. This is now when I'm in my, you know, Sid and Nancy Spungen in the hotel room level of it. This is called Overdosing. This takes place October 21st and 22nd in 1995. And when you look at the book, I sent my calendars from this time. I would obsessively write down, and you'll see that I see 12 movies in this space of time. I'll explain. A shimmering, satanic, alien insect head is hovering over London, and I can't remember if the dinosaurs are coming back or not. I've spent all of an autumn weekend, Saturday and Sunday, both days starting at 10 a.m., inside the DGA Theater, watching a marathon Hammer Film Festival. With a few exceptions, it's a very rich, color-saturated marathon. It's a marathon where I'm seeing a lot of the same people over and over again. Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, the indispensable sad-eyed Michael Ripper, buxom women with creamy skin and tight, frightened mouths and impeccable diction. The first day whips by in quick succession. Revenge of Frankenstein, Die, Die, My Darling, The Mummy, Prehistoric Women, The Vampire Lovers, The Reptile, and Plague of the Zombies. When Tallulah Bankhead has her meltdown near the end of Die, Die, My Darling and breaks out her secret stash of forbidden lipstick, I'm still 4 hours away from Ingrid Pitt's bathtub scene in The Vampire Lovers and the fang marks on many a heaving bosom. It was midnight when I staggered out onto the darkened lot, the plot and details of The Plague of the Zombies already leaking out of my skull forever. I got home, checked off the titles in my Psychotonic Encyclopedia of Films, and went to sleep. Only to wake up the next morning at 8, eat a hurried breakfast, and head back to the DGA for a 10 a.m. screening of X the Unknown, followed by When Dinosaurs Rule the Earth, 5 Million Years to Earth, which was in Cult Movies Volume 3, another one of my film books, Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, and Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter. Playwright Jack Gelber, who penned The Connection, wrote an interesting essay about overdosing on films. He was living in New York in the 60s when Times Square was a bleak, sleazy wasteland and the all-day, all-night grindhouse theaters ruled the landscape. And in the middle of a personal crisis, he spent several sleepless days wandering from one theater to the next, watching film after film nonstop. And he got to a point where all the films he'd seen, gangster pictures, westerns, schlocky sex romps, Z-grade horror movies, started to blend together into one massive, daymare-fueled mega-narrative. Humphrey Bogart and Randolph Scott having sex with space aliens. Now on a Sunday evening near the end of the brilliant 5 Million Years to Earth, when our scientist hero, Quatermass, is realizing that maybe our perceptions of God and the devil are just psychic mind slog from a crashed alien spaceship, and the very, very British James Donald is riding the construction crane into the glowing insect alien's head to destroy the vision virus that's infecting the planet, I experienced slippage. I was partially exhausted, which didn't help, but suddenly the alien insect head turned into Tallulah Bankhead's face, hovering over Hobbs End, London, screaming about lipstick and God. Mummies, cave women, and lesbian vampires came spilling out of her mouth. A gigantic Peter Cushing, tight-lipped and driven as Dr. Frankenstein, appeared to sew Tallulah's mouth shut. But her hellish, progeny were loose on the streets, and somewhere nearby, Christopher Lee opened the door to the reptile women's cage, and she pounced on the shambling mummy, sinking her tusky fangs into his powdery, rotting shoulder. I blinked hard. I was awake. I'd made friends with a school teacher named Dana, who was also there for the duration. He seemed more amused by the lineup of films than I was. He was also probably not the owner of a pagan shrine of 5 movie books crouching at home for him to check the titles off in. He wasn't quite the sprocket fiend like me, with absolutely nothing else to do in a weekend but stack it with films. Oh, shit, I realize now I was judging him. Dana had one arm. He'd lost it to cancer. Being the film freak I was, I never bothered to ask him about it further, or even what his last name was. Not enough time before or between films. A one-armed school teacher teaching kids in the LA school district, probably full of more stories and personality than the electric fables being projected above us, but I was more focused on the mummies and vampires and dinosaurs and aliens to take a deeper interest in an actual, unique human being sitting right there next to me. Such was my addiction at that point, cut off from the world, a ghost, but breathing and jacketed with flesh. I looked over at Dane, and he must have seen something in my eyes. "You okay?" he whispered. I said, "All these movies, they're kind of blending." Dana laughed and then suppressed it. "I know what you mean. It's kind of cool, isn't it?" I didn't say anything. I was dead set on a course of cutting off more and more human contact in my life, of cutting off more and more life so that I could devour more movies, you know, so that I could become a director. Though I imagine you should probably know something about human dimensions and connections and all the facets of emotion if you're ever going to want to put anything memorable on screen like Casablanca or Kids. But all I was focused on in the initial heat of my addiction were the 2 dimensions of the screen and the ritual of my 5 movie books. 5 million years to Earth ended and Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed began. It was 8 p.m. on a Sunday night. Peter Cushing is extraordinary in that movie, and even my exhaustion, fog, and slippage couldn't dilute Cushing's sharp-edged, misanthropic tour de force in what is, hands down, Hammer Film's best Frankenstein movie. Halfway through the movie, after Dr. Frankenstein has charmed and sweet-talked the widow of a man he secretly cut up and restitched into what will be a confused, pathetic monster, Cushing turns to the camera, to his 2 unwilling associates, and barks, "Pack! We're leaving!" It's a verbal gunshot, and it's the last thing I remember from the 2-day Iditarod of cinema. Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter started immediately after Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed ended. Carolyn Monroe is in that one. I can't remember a single frame. I sat there. I stared at the screen while it was projected. I couldn't tell you a single thing about it. Dana and I walked out onto the empty DGA theater lot. It's midnight. 12 movies in 2 days. "We made it," said Dana, grinning. "We did," I said. "We stood there." "Well, I'll see you," said Dana. I think my glazed, jittery, pupiled look unnerved him. He walked away west down Sunset, 3 blocks east. I'd parked the other way. I watched him go and then, eerily enough, stopped myself from saying, "Pack, we're leaving," out loud. And that is the depths of my addiction, folks. So, yeah. Hi, guys. Oh.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
A lot of green and silver and blue out here. A lot of Green Lantern fans. I like that. That's Hal Jordan's uniform, right? Yeah.
Okay. So I guess I met Patton in the mid-90s. I was living in L.A.
Yeah.
And we'd run into each other a lot, and I followed his rise and rise. And
my rise. It sounded like a virus. I followed his rise.
In 2008, I moved up here, and it would take dynamite to get me out of here now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that brings up my first question. I'm just going to dive in.
Go ahead.
One time you told me that good comics are always stoked to play Seattle. What's so special about us?
I think with Seattle, especially if you do Bumbershoot, it's one of those places, and I've described this before, America, as psychotic as it is, has these little bubbles of sanity in the middle of, you know, like Austin, Texas, Madison, Wisconsin, Athens, Georgia, and Seattle, Washington, are these places where, for some reason, it's just like this unspoken, we're all cool here, right? Is everyone, we're all good here? Like, the rest of the state might be a little crazy. We're all good here. Yeah. And the very first time that I ever came here to do Bumbershoot, I left with this, I had some of the best sets of my life because the audiences are so cool. They are fans of the form. They have no expectations about the performers, and you're really allowed to go other places. It's one of those cities that okay comics can suddenly become amazing, and amazing comics can become transcendent. So at the time, I think I was okay. I was doing pretty good, but I left. I had a really bad couple of months after I left Bumbershoot because I left going, I think I'm the new Bill Hicks. Like, I'm really. And then the next week, you know, I'm at as Blaine Kapatch would say, I was at Befuddled's in Charleston, West Virginia. And you're suddenly like, oh, no, you're not actually. And now I tell people, now I get to be like the old master when I see young comedians come to Bumbershoot for the first time. I'm like, enjoy yourself. Don't get used to this. This is not, you're not as good as this weekend is going to make you feel.
Yeah.
So just enjoy it. Now, I don't know what it is about Seattle, and I almost don't want to analyze it. I just want it to be without me picking it apart. But it's one of those cities where I can go, oh, thank God, this will be fun when I come here.
Amen.
It's
brother.
True. I mean, it is.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you about things from Silver Screen Fiend, but also from its sister book, Zombie Spaceship Wasteland.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe move some of the back catalog a little bit here.
This is all about moving units, George. Got to move units tonight. Yeah, there you go.
Do you remember writing either book?
I wasn't Stephen King in my Tommyknockers phase. I remember actually doing this. By the way, I love Stephen King, but in his memoir on writing, he said he was so drunk out of his mind, he can't remember writing Christine, Cujo, or the Tommyknockers.
Oh,
can't remember
God.
Writing them. Yeah. He would drink NyQuil for breakfast.
Oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
Hence Pennywise the Clown. So, I gotta say, I very much remember writing them because it was a struggle. I'm a voracious reader, and just like when I was a voracious film goer, I was like, oh, I could write something better than that. And then you get in front of that blank page, and like, oh my God,
yeah.
This is terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now, it says in the book that at age 5, you went to Kids' Day at the library.
Yeah.
And for some reason, you were shown F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu.
Yeah, exactly. I was living in Tustin Meadows, California, very briefly, a military brat, and 5 years old. Oh, it's Halloween, the activity day, the library, we go there. We make pumpkin cookies. We cut out bats and ghosts. And then we hear a ghost story. And then I think the adults, and there was no malice in this, but it's 1974, so they just went, oh, well, it's an old silent movie. That'll be okay for kids. Things were okay back then. And they showed us Nosferatu, which if you've ever seen it or if you saw it and you haven't seen it in a while, that movie is the closest thing besides Orson Welles' The Trial that recreates nightmare rhythms on screen.
Yeah.
And when you're a little kid and you've got that, your mind is still forming and you know, fantasy reality kind of blend, it looked like we were looking through a window at this other horrible world where any minute they could just kind of turn and look at us and then try to... It's bad news. I'm telling you,
yeah.
Parents out there, let your kids... Let your kids see Bad Lieutenant before they see any silent movie, because it's just so creepy. I would say even silent comedies. There's just something about the undercranked camera and the movements. It's just for little kids. They don't like it. It gives them the willies.
Yeah. Now, unlike most comedians, you know the exact date you first stepped on stage, which was July 18th, 1988.
Yeah.
What propelled you to try stand-up?
It was one of those summers. It was the summer between my freshman and sophomore year of college. And I think a lot of you have had a summer like this, too, where I was like, I better start trying to figure out what I'm going to do as a person. I just didn't know how I was going to live. So I tried every job I could that summer. I was working at a law firm, training to be a paralegal. I was writing a sports column under my own name for a local paper. I was writing another column under an assumed name for a different paper. I was DJing on the weekends for weddings. It was a nightmare. And and then I said, people seem to think I'm funny. I'll try stand-up. And all those other jobs paid pretty good, but if any of them had gone away, I would have gone, meh, like I didn't care either way. And stand-up was instantly awful. Like I just ate it horribly, and I loved it so much. And I couldn't get enough of it. And I was like, philosophically, the thing that is giving me absolutely no positive reinforcement that I want to keep doing no matter what is probably what I should do with my life. Like that... Right there, that's what I should probably be doing. So,
well, and you note that after 4 years of steady stand-up gigs, you were making $7,000 a year.
$7,000 a year, yeah. That's right, $7,000 a year. Yeah. Before, yeah, I was, all I wanted to do was stand-up, so I learned very, very quickly how to live on no money, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, at first when I was doing stand-up in... between 88 and 92, I moved to Baltimore for a year and then went, wait a minute, I should be saving my money. So I moved back in with my parents for another year and then spent nothing obsessively and got up enough money to drive across country because I was going to move to San Francisco. And then in Truckee, California, my Jetta dropped its water pump on the highway and I had to pull over in town, stay there for 3 days and get it fixed, and it blew all my money. And then I pulled into San Francisco broke. Like it was like a bad, you know, like a Waylon Jennings song. Just it was so perfect. But yeah.
Isn't it funny how water pumps only seem to exist when you're broke?
They really do. Oh yeah. I mean it was all as Blaine Kapach, again, to quote him, he's like, we're just working for rent and ramen right now. You would drive 2 hours out to Montecito to do a one-nighter that paid you enough money to get enough gas to get yourself back to San Francisco and be broke again. And that was it. And you would eat dinner at the, like, you do like a one-nighter at a Cask and Cleaver, and they would give you a free dinner, and that was your dinner. And then you would take leftovers and eat that the next day. It was absolutely second to second. How do I scam a meal here and stop from dying?
Now, your early material was about masturbation.
Yes.
Farting.
Yep.
And also superheroes farting and shooting things out their ass.
Yes, it really was, yeah. It was, you know, I was a, like a, you know, in, like a Mark Twain. When I was starting out, I was up and down the East Coast doing these horrible one-nighters, and what I learned first as a stand-up was how to just entertain the quickest and easiest, lowest common denominator, a room full of drunks on a Thursday night in a sports bar, what will get their attention. And so it's jerking off. And I remember I read an interview years later with Beck, and someone asked him, you know, your songs always mention the devil, even if it's in passing. Yeah. He goes, well, I learned really early because I played a lot of strip clubs, and the only way to get people to stop me is if I would mention the devil for some reason. So these guys would be like with their heads down drinking, and you say like the devil, and they'd go, what? It would like look up, and it would get. So he just puts the devil in all of his songs, and for me it was farting and masturbation was my Beck's devil was farting for me basically.
So you got into San Francisco, and the day after you got there, I guess, you walked into a club called the Holy City Zoo.
And all right.
Yeah.
I had been doing... I've been doing 4 years of stand-up at that point, 88 to 92. I'd gotten what I thought was really good. When I moved to San Francisco, I was making, you ready, 11 grand a year. That's right. Yeah, double digit. I could afford two bulk bags of rice at the Food for Less. I was living. I rode the bus like a king. So I had gotten pretty competent as a road comic, and now I'm going into this room called the Holy City Zoo, which was the springboard for everyone that was ever innovative and risk-taking comedy. And the night that I did it, you know, there was this legendary room for comedians. So when I went in there, it was May 5th, 1992, the crowd was just comedians. The place, even if that place was sold out, it held 60 people when it was packed. That's how tiny that room was. I go in, and it looks like a pretty good crowd. I'm like, huh. And it took me a second to realize, oh, this is all comedians. They're all comedians, and they're there to just do their stuff. And in that room that night was Margaret Cho, Greg Proops, all these, like, amazing comedians. And then I go up, and I do my A-road stuff. My A-level road material, and it just, it doesn't even eat it. It just gets this very polite, like, yeah, of course that shit works, but we're not, you know, like, yeah. Everybody was doing all this really innovative stuff, yeah. And it was so, this awakening of, it was that moment of, you can stay on the road and do this awful shit you're doing, or yeah. You can change or die, basically, you know, and it was that thing of, and there's a lot of comedians that, there's a lot of very successful hacks who also had their Holy City Zoo moment, maybe if not in the Holy City Zoo, in some other room, and instead they doubled down and dug their heels in and became very, very wealthy hacks and are resentful that, like, but I'm making millions of dollars, why haven't I earned the respect? And I know this sounds really douchey, but it wasn't about the money at that point. At that point in time, it was about, can you do something totally new and totally risk-taking? None of us were trying to get sitcoms. None of us were trying to get The Tonight Show. The Tonight Show was gone. You know, it was this whole new world.
So then a year after you got to this place, which was kind of a haven for you, it closed down.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, the boom years of stand-up comedy were over at that point, right?
Yeah. I mean, the boom years were, the boom was already dying when I started in 88. I decided, well, I'll stake my future on a industry that is going away. So I just had to keep heading west because clubs just kept closing across the country. And I made it to San. When I got to San Francisco, there were 10 comedy clubs. A year later, there were 2 left, and there were also, you could go on stage every single night and work out. And the Holy City Zoo, we always thought would be there because it was never a money making proposition anyway. But it just got so hard, it got so brutal, that they just finally had to close it. But what happened because of that was, it was scary at first, and then comedians, that's what started the whole, well, we just got to start our own room then. Like, I can't own a comedy club, but I can go into a bookstore, a bar. I've done them in laundromats. I've done them in, literally, where you just go, hey, can I plug in a mic and can we do a show? And they're like, if you pay for it, you're fine. And we had to promote it ourselves, flyer it, get people in. It was a very interesting time.
All right. So then you moved to Los Angeles, and I think the first time I saw you was about 20 years ago at the Uncabaret in West Hollywood.
Yeah.
It was a little tiny club, another one of those 60-seaters, I think, roughly. And Beth Lapidus and her husband, Greg Miller, had launched a new kind of comedy show on Sunday nights that was packed with schlubbily dressed neurotics. Usually holding a notebook. Spontaneity was prized.
Yes.
And these funny men and women rambled and mumbled and stumbled, and some of them seemed to be drunk or on drugs. This was alternative comedy.
Yeah, that was a room where it became, because the comedy had so commodified itself at that point. It had become just a series of motions that you went through, that even the people that were just happy to have a drink and just watch the, why can't the professor fix the boat on Gilligan's Island? even they were getting sick of it. So, yeah. And Beth was the first one that really saw that, oh, people are starting their own rooms and talking about what's going on in their worlds rather than what, oh my God, what's these more esoteric things, more like, I'm 23 years old, I'm confused, I don't know what the fuck's going on. And that was being brought up on stage. And the Uncabaret was the first place that really crystallized that. And then, but then got really, really crazy. I mean, you were there on nights where you couldn't move in that room. It was so packed. And it was also with the first room, even before the Largo, where you had to descend these stairs to go down. Yeah. And it got to be so crazy that the fire marshal would start to show up, and the comedians, as a comedian, you couldn't watch the show unless until you were on stage. In other words, you each got called down one by one because there was only one extra space for one more human That's to move great. Through and get to that little stage. And I remember one night, I walked down the stairs, and then they're like, Patton, you're on, go down now, and the next person. And I remember the very recently late brilliant Taylor Negron had just gone on before me and was passing me on the stairs. And I went, wow. So I go, who's on stage now? And he just went, Cher, and then just like walked away. Like it was so, because it was just, the room was a sweatbox. But then I walked in this and I passed these three guys and it took me a second. I didn't realize I had just walked by the Beastie Boys were there to watch the show. And it was just this terrifying, like, oh my God, what is going on? So yeah, that room was amazing. And I like, you'd be there like what Andy Dick would go on stage and have a nervous breakdown and like literally curl up in a ball and start crying. Yeah. It was just amazing. It was amazing.
I remember one time for Valentine's Day, he had made this very elaborate thing with a felt Valentine that had yarn tied to it in various spots, and it was supposed to go out into the audience, and people were supposed to hold the yarn, and then he was going to do something with it, and he just said, it, and he just threw the thing away in it.
I was there the night that he had just done a college gig that had gone horribly wrong, and they had cut the mic halfway through it, and all the students like rioted, and it was the college all pissed off, and there was a blurb about it in TV Guide about how awful, because that's when he was on news radio, and he had spent the day driving around Hollywood buying every copy of TV Guide that he could so that nobody could read the article, and he brought them all up on stage in these huge shopping bags and then was reading the article, and he was like he was on every drug you could imagine, and then was just reading these articles and crying, and then ended up lying on his side on the stage bawling, and then Beth had to go up and pick him up, and then as she's taking him off stage, she's crying, she's like, ladies and gentlemen, Patton Oswalt. And then I did, like, what? And I went up on stage and just by the way he called me shortly after that show. I'll never forget this call. He was like, Patton, it's Andy, listen, I want you to write a screenplay for me. Would you do that? And I said, yeah, I guess. I mean, what's the idea for the movie? He goes, well, it's sort of a kind of a Waiting for Guffman kind of thing. And I can pay you $8,000. And I said, well, look, I don't want to sound like a snot rag, but that's like way below guild minimum if I'm going to write a screenplay. And then he goes, what if I told you that Madonna was putting up the money? And then I said, well, Madonna money isn't worth more than regular money. It's still $8,000. Like, I doesn't. So.
So a year or two after Uncabaret, Cafe Largo opened up. Run by Mark Flanagan, and it just had another dazzling parade of comedy deities, including Mitch Hedberg.
Yes.
And I remember, as a writer, one of his lines really dazzled me because it was only 13 words. I used to do drugs. I still do, but I used to, too.
My... We could sit here quoting him all night. We really could. If you're a tightrope walker and you trip walking down the sidewalk, that is unacceptable. But he had a line one night, and it's one of my credos, really, which is beware of any comedian who writes for half an hour and then says he has a half an hour of new material, which was a really good distillation of both the allure and the danger of the Largo, because the Largo had, if the crowds at the Uncabaret were amazing, then the crowds at Largo, those were the Glengarry Glen Leeds of crowds. They were just amazing. Yeah. If you ate it in front of the Largo crowd, you needed to go rethink what you were doing. Yeah. But it was also that thing, there were a lot of comedians that came up and they just did rooms like the Largo because that became the norm. And then they were, got all this heat on them in L.A. and they would get managers and agents who would then book them out on the road. And on the road, half an hour of killer stuff at the Largo translates to about three usable minutes on the road. And a lot of, like, Kathy Griffin had some really hard times out, and she would be out at the Comedy Palace in the suburbs of Boston. So it's like, it's like the whole group, the whole audience is just like Goodwill Hunting characters, and and she's up there, you know, talking about Brooke Shields' plastic surgery, and they're like, "What the fuck?" You know, so it was. And I did a week in Vegas, and I was like trying to talk about Sam Fuller on stage, and people were like, "What the hell are you saying?" At one point, I was making fun of Forrest Gump, the movie Forrest Gump, because I didn't like it. And then someone said, "It made a lot of money, you." I was like, "Okay, I guess you're right."
Well, I just wanted to read a list of the people who performed there
that
I personally saw in a short period of just a few years. Andy Kindler,
weak,
Dana Gould,
lame.
Jim Turner,
hack.
Patton Oswalt,
no,
Louis C.K., Greg Barrett, Meryl Marco, Emo Phillips, Andy Dick, Janine Garofalo, Taylor Negron, Sarah Silverman, Bobcat Goldthwait, Karen Kilgariff, Kathy Griffin, Bob Odenkirk, Margaret Cho, Blaine Kapach, Julia Sweeney, Terry Sweeney, Joel Hodgson, Marilyn Rice Cub, David Cross, and Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah. Every Monday for $5, that was the show. And you would see, I mean, not all of
some
them,
of
but
people,
I mean, there were, that was a, pick any of those five and you would see them for $5 on a Monday night with, you know, and there were nights, I remember when Greg Proops would host, it would almost backfire because he was so good. The other, he would bulldozer his own show because he was so funny that no one else could follow him. Like he was just hosting. And he was so amazing up there that you were just like, just let it, don't bring anyone else up. We just keep talking. Like it was it was amazing. And then also the shows that happened, Naked Trucker, John Bryan's Friday Night Show, the Acoustic Vaudeville, where whatever comedian was opening up, I was one of them. Amy Mann and Michael Penn hate to do stage banter, so we would do their stage banter for them. In between, we would go up and just say the, like, I was in a really bad place when I wrote this next song. And it would have nothing to do with the song that was good. It was just the dumbest. And then they had to start their song after we gave them the worst intro. So
you write that at Largo, even one killer set really could change your career.
That was one of, there was a, again, I'm very, very much against telling people, you know, if you go on stage, like once, you got to go on stage over and over and over again, or write, you know, write over, whatever you got to do. But there are these moments in time, they don't last. The Ed Sullivan Show, the Comedy Store during the 70s and 80s, the Largo in the 90s, where, and the Tonight Show in the 70s and 80s, where there are windows where one set can completely change your career. The next day, things are now different because of one set you did. And I mean, I'm evidence of it. I would do sets at the Largo. I walked off stage one night, went back in the kitchen to hang out. Paul Thomas Anderson was hanging out there, and he was like, "That was great. Are you? I'm making a movie. You want to be in it?" And I'm like, yeah, you know. The next day, I was getting fitted for my scuba suit for Magnolia. Fantastic. Or I come on stage and the Farrelly brothers would be hanging out going, hey, we need you to punch up our scripts. Just come to the beach house and hang out. And suddenly I'm a script doctor from one set that I did. So that was, for a while, that could happen. Although sometimes that would also not really backfire, but it would lead to really hilarious things. One night, Greg Barrett and Paul F. Tompkins were on stage riffing, and they riffed a thing about, and they were doing it just as a joke. They were riffing a show called Centaur in the City, where it's a guy whose roommate is a centaur, and they're just like, you know, you stretched out my pants, or, you know, but... the audience was just dying because of how dumb it was.
Yeah.
You know, but there was an executive from MTV in the room that was like, this is killing. Like, I gotta hear this pitch. So brought them in for a pitch.
Oh my God.
And of course, Greg and Paul were like, we have to do this. Yes. Like, just see what happens. So they're in there pitching it, and at one point, the guy, they're like, well, no, why? The executive is trying to do her job by asking questions about the script. And they're like, we're just doing this as a goof. I don't know what to. So at one point she said, now, how does a centaur, which I'm pretty sure is from Greek myth, end up in a 20th century apartment in Manhattan? And so then one of them, I forgot who said it, said, I think that the centaur was up on Mount Olympus and did something and got Zeus angry, and Zeus zapped him forward in time. And then the executive said, I don't think Zeus has that power. And then, and I don't know who said it, I forgot who said it, but then the meeting ended by one of them going, well, let's call our fake lawyer in Pretend Town and find out if he does. Like, it was just the dumb. And then like, the room just chill, yeah. Get out. It was just this.
Okay, so you then got a job writing for Mad TV.
Yes.
Working at what was once Desilu Studios. That's pretty cool. And by your own admission, you were kind of a lazy, whining malcontent.
I was a head. I was, because I was there, it's my first writing job on a show, so all I have is my youth, all of these ideals about pushing the envelope and, you know, my idols, people like Doug Kenny and Michael O'Donohue, and right across town, Bob and David doing Mr. Show at the same time and watching what they're doing, and I'm over at, you know, at Mad TV going, I don't know, how about Midnight in the Olive Garden of Good and Evil? I don't know. So and getting notes like, this Hitler sketch is funny. Does he have to be so anti-Semitic? So we had, by the way, we actually got, there was a note session, a guy, Gary Campbell, writer for Kids in the Hall, one of the best comedy writers out there, wrote a sketch, and the sketch was a guy is doing the eulogy at his friend's funeral, and it becomes clear during the eulogy that the friend died owing him $15, and he's bitter about it, and he's passively aggressively like sniping at his friend. And one of the network people were like, well, shouldn't the guy, I mean, $15, who cares? I mean, he should have died owing him like $50,000. And we had to then argue that.
Oh.
We had to basically argue someone who did not understand how comedy worked.
Yeah.
But throwing butter through a window, it wouldn't transform into a butterfly. Butter is a dairy product, and then a butterfly is an insect. It doesn't do that. So that doesn't make sense.
So after a day when you would play Doom and Hexen and you would, after work, you had a ritual. You would wash your face and brush your teeth in the men's room.
Yes.
Then buy two trays of sushi and an Evian at Ralph's Market.
Yep.
You would then consume this dinner in the car as you drove to the New Beverly Theater or the New Art or some other art house cinema.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And that's where you saw your hundreds of movies ranging from last year at Marienbad to Bloodsucking Freaks.
Yeah. Yeah, I would do that and then try to maybe go to do a set afterward if I could time it just right. Like, okay, last year at Marion Bad starts at 7:30. It'll end at, you know, maybe 9:30. So I either go into the Largo or whatever is, you know, again, I can name a million places. They literally don't exist anymore. I could go to Tempest. I could go to the Diamond Club, like, and see about getting on stage. Or do I stay for the second feature? It depends. And then do I then check it off? Like, it was also this, it turned into this really creepy sports ritual where it was about, if I see these movies and they're listening to these five movie books I have that I was using for reference and I check them off, it'll help me have a good set either that night or the next night. It became that, you know, I can't change my socks during a pennant race or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So these are really obsessive notes. And I noticed certain things. For instance, on a single day, you saw The Shining and The Exorcist.
Yep.
In fact, you'd often see two or more movies in a day at different theaters, which I don't think I've ever done.
Yeah, I'd be driving around town to get, like, I would go from the Orpheum downtown LA, all the way out to the Newark, which could not be further away. Yeah. Just to see, you know, make sure, because they're both in these movie books. I can check them off. And if you checked off two movies in one day, that was extra good. Like, it was just weird. So crazy.
And this led to a lot of mismatched pairs, including Picnic at Hanging Rock and Armageddon.
Yeah.
Once Upon a Time in the West and Space Jam. Hurley Burley and Patch Adams.
And by the way, Hurley Burley and Patch Adams, and what day was that on?
Christmas
Day. That was a Christmas Day in Los Angeles. A bunch of friends of mine, we all got baked, went to the 11:30. It was like orphans. It was everyone who hadn't gone to visit their family. We all called each other up on our phones because we on at home. We didn't text back then. And got stoned and went and saw Patch Adams and a friend of ours all made clown noses for us and then got little baby arms and glued the baby arm to the, because remember on the poster the little kid's hand is reaching up to squeeze his nose, so we all wore those. And then and I'm still baked, and then I drive, so that was at the Galaxy, and then I drove from there to the Sunset Five and saw Hurley Burley, and then as I was leaving Hurley Burley, now it's 9 o'clock on Christmas Day Eve, and I'm riding there. When you get to the Sunset Five, it's a big escalator that goes up and another one that goes down to get to the theater. Mm-hmm. I'm riding it down and coming up the other escalator in sweatpants and a sweat jacket with a hood is by himself Robert De Niro, just descending.
Oh, good Lord.
And he's ascending as I'm going down, but he's ascending with that look like, don't recognize me. Don't even do it. And I just, like, left him alone, like, okay, I guess, like,
So apparently all this compulsive movie viewing actually kind of worked. It seemed to spur your creativity because you started working harder and you started taking more risks and honing your work, and you started to draw crowds that weren't just out for a night of comedy. They came there to see you in particular. And do you remember a moment when you felt like I finally have reached hit my stride and reached the point where I was aiming?
Well, I mean, for me, it wasn't until about 1997 or 98, when I've been doing it almost, you know, 10 years, mm-hmm. that I felt confident enough on stage that I was using I had found my own voice, in that the way I'm talking to you right now was the exact same way I would talk when I would go on stage. Up to that point, mm-hmm. I would still get into this little headspace, like, got to get my stage voice on and my stage presence, and I had finally erased that line where mm-hmm. I could go on stage, and because of that connection, then it wasn't until that year that it was. I remember there was a time at I was at Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco when I would start into a bit, and I saw people in the audience look at their friends like, "This is the bit I like." That thing of, "I brought you here to hear this thing that I like," and that was like, "Holy!"
Wow.
Like that really. And also in that same weekend, this was in late '98. It was the first time that someone that came and saw me on a Thursday night showed up again on a Saturday night. And that was this, like, oh, my God, they came back again. So that meant a lot to me. That was like, oh, wow, I might be doing something right here.
Well, apparently you are. Twitter says that you have over 2 million followers.
They're all porn bots. They're all...
Well, sure, some of them are porn bots. But when somebody crosses you, are you ever tempted to send out a tweet that says, kill my pretties, kill?
The only time I've ever done anything like that, like, you know, forward my minions is for something I would hope would be, like, socially conscious, like if there's some corporation that's f***ing someone over. Like, a few years ago, Progressive was just, like, openly f***ing this family over, and the news of it hit, like, Gawker and other sites. So it wasn't like I was trying to publicly shame them, but it was just like this, hey, let's get some spotlight on this stuff. But for the most part, I try to use it to, A, selfishly promote myself. That's the main reason, and I don't have altruism only goes so far. But it's also like I try to really use it to get the word out about stuff I like that's not getting the attention I think it deserves. Also for selfish reasons, if I can make stuff like, you know, like a writer like Garrett Kaiser sell more books, or a show like Broad City get more viewers, then more stuff that I like will get viewed. If that, you know, so I'm really into that. And especially like the other thing that I do too, the one thing I hate on Twitter is something that they do, people do, called Follow Friday, and it's a hashtag where they try to get, and look, it comes from a good place. They want people to follow people that they like. But what I do is if there's a young comedian who's tweeting really funny stuff, I'll just retweet a bunch of their stuff. And retweeting it when it's making me laugh and 2 million people see it, that gets that person a lot of followers.
Sure. So now you're pretty much...
You're welcome. Yeah. No, that's... So but now, there are some people that, you know, like Megan Amram kind of owes her career to Twitter, and she'll tell you that. Like, and it was... And all of us comedians would read her stuff and go, oh, my God, and just retweet her, and then the next thing you know, people are like, hey, you're hired. This is great. So
you're prospering. You're really at the apex of Mount Comedy. And I just kind of
wonder... The plummet's coming. It's so close. It's all going to collapse. I don't know how, but...
What do you find to complain about these days? I'm just curious. Oh, God.
Well, I mean, you know, the good thing about when you reach the apex of Mount Comedy at age 46 is, luckily, your body begins to betray you, so you can then start bitching about oncoming death and the unfairness of, why do I have this wisdom now when my feet hurt all the time? Like, why didn't I have this when I was young and healthy? And then also, like, you can just perceive a lot more of... You, as you get older, you just pick better targets. When I was younger, all of the stuff that I bitched about was I was bitching about stuff to make myself look smarter and point out what was dumb about the world. Now, I try to connect with people more by revealing what the stuff that bothers me in the world is the stuff that originates from me and from my misconceptions and ignorance and, you know, stupidity and ego about things. You know, there was stuff. And also, I mean, the one thing about Twitter is it's like a ticker tape record of me learning stuff. Like there was, the Holy City Zoo, there was I used to lean on as a comedian that I thought was funny until I heard other people's viewpoints and went, oh, there's a higher way to attack this stuff and hit better targets than the way that I used to be doing it. I mean, I'm not... Again, I'm all about change or die, and the, you know, all these people that are like, just like last week when after the State of the Union, when Obama was saying, I want to make community college free. Now, look, it's a pipe dream, but he wants to do it. He's going to try. And all these pundits were saying, well, I had to pay for college when I was coming up. Yeah, I know, and that sucked. And we're gonna try to change. Like, just because something was a way, that'd be like me going, well, I didn't have the internet. Why do people have the internet now? Like... Because change when we realized it was bad and we tried to make it better. What the f*** is wrong with people?
Okay, so...
I'm sorry, I just... Right. Like, the reason... Look, I understand... Look, I'm not for... I'm not for just blanket change for change's sake, but the argument against changing something cannot be, but that used to not be that way. Well, but if that's the rationale, then we should still have slavery, you know? Because we used to have, why are blacks just walking? That's not how it was a while ago. That's the dumbest rationale on the planet.
Agreed. Okay.
All right.
So we're going to get to some audience questions in a minute or two. So if you have any last-minute things you want to write down, there's still time to pass them to the aisles, and the ushers will collect them. In the meantime, I will ask you a couple of questions that poured in on the internet.
Poured in on the internet. Yeah. And I used to not get questions on the internet. I'm not going to listen to those.
Here's one. Do you remember the first R-rated movie you saw?
Yes, I do.
I think we all
do.
Well,
the first one that I got taken to see, not the first one I saw behind my parents' back. The ones I saw without my parents knowing were stuff like Caddyshack and, you know, on my friend's videotape. But my dad, when I was 11, took me to see Excalibur in a theater. Because his rationale was, well, that's how it was back then. It was horrible and violent, so it's historical. And I loved it. I was just so happy. It was an amazing movie. And then years later, I have one scene in a movie called Calendar Girls with, my scene's with Helen Mirren. And I was like, hey, you were the first R-rated movie that I got to see when I was 11 years old, Excalibur. She goes, oh, lovely. Did you enjoy my breasts? And I said, I did. Oh, good Lord, did I enjoy those breasts.
Here's another one. One movie I can't stand because it's logically lazy is the very popular film Little Miss Sunshine. Are there some popular films you can't stand but bite your tongue when people are praising them?
Yeah. There's a couple. The two that have really, really bothered me, and every time people are like, what? Are Field of Dreams. Just something, and the movie's got a good heart, but there's a smugness behind it. I can't put my finger on it, but it really, really, it's almost like that movie gave birth to the annoying in Whole Foods. Like, it can be traced back to Field of Dreams. It's something in there.
Yes.
And then the other one that really bothers me is, and it's for the most petty reason, it's The English Patient. I hate that movie. It's terrible. And the dialogue, like, I remember I saw it I didn't read anything about it. I just went to see it. And then he's like, you can't kill me. I died a long time ago. Oh, are you kidding me? That's like... And then the next thing I know, it's like winning all these awards. It was like, it was that, you know, am I taking crazy pills? That line from, I just didn't know what was going on. So I just cannot stand it.
Okay. Do we have any of those questions? I've got one more here. Let's see. Do you have a memorable drive-in movie story?
I just missed the drive-ins. Where I was growing up, there weren't any drive-ins. It was in the suburbs of Northern Virginia. The only drive-in movie I've ever seen was a one out in, like, El Monte that I went to, like, 5 years ago with a bunch of friends. Like, oh, let's go to a drive-in and enjoy it. And we went and saw Swordfish. And but I went to just sit on the back of a friend's car and get high. Like, I missed the whole... And I have friends older than me that tell me these crazy stories about the drive-in, but I miss that. I wish I could have experienced that.
That's one of the phenomena that really blindsided me. When that went away, I couldn't believe it because I thought, what's wrong with a drive-in? It's fun. It's crazy. Okay.
Well, what was your memory? You went to the drive-in a lot?
Yes, I did.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's see. One time we were in the back of a pickup truck and some... sleazy girls in the pickup truck next to us.
Oh, sleazy girls.
they came over and they got into our pickup truck with us.
Uh-huh.
And then later...
You were 8 years old, by the way.
This was in Tucson. And then later I heard that...
Oh, that explains everything then, yeah.
I heard one of the guys got...
Oh, God. Yeah. But everyone else is sitting in the bed of the pickup truck.
Yeah. Well, there was a blanket.
Oh, so secret...
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember what movie was playing?
No, I don't, but... It was probably one of those, like, R-rated sex comedies.
Right, yeah.
That they don't really make as much anymore.
I know, there was that whole period of the 80s where literally every weekend it was just, like, joysticks, or it was all, like, what euphemism for can we come up with the title, you know? Getting lucky. Like, oh, okay.
Okay, here's a question. Can you tell us about your filibuster scene on Parks and Rec?
all that is it's 8 minutes of terror. That's all you're watching. I love Parks and Rec so much. I love that show. It is every week, for free, you get a free 22-minute Tom McCarthy film on your television. It's the best show, and I loved it since it started, and then I get called, like, do you want to play this role? So I was, oh, my God, and when you do the show, they do like three or four takes, and they do what's called a fun take, where you just riff back and forth, and they just see what happens. And so in that scene, they said, okay, all you got to do is talk for like 30 seconds, and then Amy and John Glazer will cut you off, but make like you're starting to do a filibuster. And then they'll stop you. And then the director, and because I know all the writers and directors, what I didn't know was he then said, just no one yell cut. Let's just see how long he goes. See what happens. So I just start. I start, and they're not yelling cut, and I don't want to get fired. So I just kept going. And what I learned was, you know, there's the fight or flight response.
Yeah.
But in my case, there's also the trivia dump response. That when you're scared... You just unload every bit of comic book ephemera in your head out of absolute terror that you're going to get fired.
Okay, here's a question. Are those ladies' running shoes you're wearing?
You know what? I don't know. I just know they're comfortable. I don't give a I don't know why that matters. Those are super comfortable. You know what? Whoever sent that, I hope they are. These are damn comfy. Why should... Hell yeah. That's another thing about being like 46 years old. Comfort. If I discover that a dress is more comfortable than jeans, you're going to see me in a f***ing dress. I don't give a shit. I got no one left to impress. I'm like, I'll put my dress on. I'm happy.
How did it come about that you created the Batman Smells cartoon with Bob Fingerman?
Oh, well, that was a thing, and I credit it in the comic strip. That was a thing that happened one night at the Largo. It was Bob Odenkirk and David Cross on stage, and they're riffing out a thing where they're pitching a movie, and the movie is, like, so it opens, it's the Batmobile driving in winter, and you can hear, like, jingle bells, and Batman is driving, and he just stinks. Like, he... And they do Batman, you know, Jingle Bells, Batman Smells, as if they're pitching a movie. So I did it as a comic, and then I go, I want to thank Bob and David for riffing this in front of me. I'm not sharing any of the money that I'm getting for this for you. So,
did you ever have a problem with stage fright? And if so, how'd you get over it?
I never really had a problem with stage fright. I had more of a problem with... I don't know what to call it, like stage dishonesty, like having to get into this character and this voice that wasn't me. And I guess that might have come from fright or insecurity. Mm-hmm. So I got over it just by mindless repetition chipping away until... And also it helped that early on, no one has eaten it harder than me on stage, like has had harder sets. I mean, some people have, I'm sure, but... oh my God, I've had some really nightmare sets. And then the next day, I woke up and the world didn't end. And then that slowly got me over the fear of like, you're gonna have bad sets. It doesn't end anything. You can keep going. So that, it was that, huh? Well, it was just kind of more this, hey, have you seen this? Boy, this thing was, it was just this 22-year-old kid talking like a jaded 51-year-old. I'm here to tell you guys all about everything. And I would also, I had my influences that I had to fight through. Mm. I opened for Bill Hicks one time, and then for like a year, I talked like Bill Hicks. Mm. You know, my roommate in Baltimore, this guy named Mark Voice, I talked like him for a while. You know, there's just, you have to embrace your influences so you can push through them, you know?
On the United States of Terra, how much of your dialogue was improvised? Specifically, the poop monster Neil built in the basement for Wheels.
A lot of the stuff with Wheels was improvised because I was a new dad at the time, and I was very, very cognizant of how you talk to a baby. So a lot of that stuff. But the writing on that show was terrific. And, you know, I think there's a bit of a cult of improvisation now that gets done before the fact. Like, read the script first. If the script is good and you read it, you'll look great. You don't have to throw this garbage out and just let this stallion run. Like, well, why don't you just fucking... the shit might be good. Why don't you read it first and then decide?
So here's a question you've probably gotten many times.
Oh, boy.
Would you rather fight one horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses?
Well, it on an emotional level, it would have to be the horse-sized duck only because that's an object of horror and that you would want to fight and destroy, but duck-sized horses are adorable. Like, I would want those to exist. I wouldn't hurt them at all. I would sell them and become a millionaire, but a horse-sized duck is an insult to God and has and must be destroyed.
Okay. Do you have a favorite joke I can tell my grandma?
I have a limerick you can tell her. This was taught to me, not to drop a name, this was taught to me by Christopher Hitchens. Hmm. Taught me this limerick. You can tell this to your grandmother. You ready? There once was a driver named Hunt who was given an engine to shunt. Saw a runaway truck, and by yelling out duck, saved the life of the fellow in front. Totally G-rated.
Okay, well, I think that's a good place to wrap up. Thank you, Patton Oswalt.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you value this episode or this series, please share your appreciation by posting a good review. It helps more people find us. Patton Oswalt is an American writer, actor, and comedian. His new book is Silver Screen Fiend, Learning About Life from an Addiction to Film. Seattle Arts and Lectures presented this event featuring Patton Oswalt at Town Hall Seattle on January 31st, 2015. He was joined on stage by George Meyer, a producer and writer for The Simpsons. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for this recording. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
What's that? Good luck. Good luck tomorrow. Go Seabirds.
All right.
Thanks, guys.